Thank you very much, Tom, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great honor for me and a privilege to present this keynote address this morning, and I'll do my best to live up to Tom's generous introduction. I was asked to address both the challenges and the opportunities for growth in international markets, and I think to anticipate my conclusion, I see a bright, bright future for international trade in the grains, particularly in feed grains, as well as in oil seeds. Dan Keefe opened the meeting this morning, quoting from David Ricardo, really one of the great intellectual giants of the history of economic thought, who was the first to establish why international trade is so beneficial to everybody concerned. And I think it is useful for us, anytime we're discussing trade, just to remind ourselves, why is it we trade anyway? Basically, if everything costs the same to produce in every country, there'd be no reason to have international trade. But international trade gives us the opportunity to increase our standard of living by obtaining goods that others can produce at lower cost in exchange for things that we can produce at lower cost. By lowering the cost, we lower the cost of living, and as a result, trade makes households' purchasing power extend further. And trade increases our GNPs by allowing each of us to use our land, labor, and capital in the manner which is most productive. This morning, I'll start out talking about some of the demand dynamics of international markets, talk a little bit about the trade dynamics, then production, policy, and wrap up with prospects for the future. So, diving right in with global demand dynamics, we do have to start with demography, with long-term population growth trends. And the number I'd like to have you first focus on in the top line, the change between now and 2050. Larger world population by the middle of the century by the 2.6 billion people. To put that in perspective, China has 1.3 billion people today. So the world's farmers are going to be challenged to feed two more Chinas between now and the middle of the century, or the equivalent of population of two more Chinas. And that's virtually all in the low-income countries of the world. You'll note in the high-income countries, there's only a predicted 89 million increase in population, and the United States alone is predicted to have over 100 million increase in population. So the rest of the high-income world basically is shrinking markets of the past. The markets of the future are in the presently low-income countries, which expect to have about 2.5 billion more mouths to be fed by the middle of the century. The biggest population growth, on the order of roughly 900 million each, will be in South Asia, as well as Sub-Saharan Africa. Sub-Saharan Africa is the only region of the world projected to double its population in the next 40 years. Largest countries, interesting shifting in the ranking. By the middle of the century, India is projected to have more than 300 million larger population than China. As you see, the United States is projected to grow actually more than 110 million, and then a list of developing countries whose populations are growing relatively rapidly and displacing some of the historical countries in the top 10 markets. But that's the opportunity. But we have to remember that population growth alone does not a market make. You have to have purchasing power to go with the population. Population growth creates need. And we have 1.4 billion people living on less than a dollar and a quarter a day, and about 925 million of them go to bed hungry every night, simply do not have the purchasing power to avail themselves of enough calories to sustain a medium level of physical activity. About 2.6 billion people live on less than $2 a day, and this dollar and a quarter and $2 a day, these are in purchasing power adjusted terms. So this is real purchasing power. By about $2 a day, most people's hunger problems are solved. They can afford enough calories, but by no stretch of the imagination do they have a balanced diet with enough vitamins, minerals, protein in their diets. But what's really important for our purposes today is the point that as people's incomes grow from $1 to $2, up to about $10 per day per capita, that's where we get virtually all of the growth in demand for raw agricultural products. Because after about $10 a day, increments of income that get spent on food get spent on convenience, processing, packaging, variety, maybe luxury forms, eating out more frequently in restaurants, but not on raw agricultural products. So this means that the single most important factor in determining the future size of world demand for food is how many hundreds of millions or billions of people successfully escape from poverty and move up the ranks of to $1 to $2 to about $10 a day per capita income. And there are a lot of people in the big developing countries of the world who still are in that $1.25 and $2 a day income level. Look at China. China has obviously gotten lots of press about its rapid economic growth, and it's all true. But there are a number of people left behind in interior China who are still living at the $1.25, $2 a day. India has huge numbers of people in that category. The point here is that to the extent that these countries you see on this list and the other developing countries are successful in their poverty reduction strategies, this will have as much effect on growth and demand for food as population growth itself. And in fact, we've had record rates of poverty reduction in East and South Asia in the last couple of decades. And in South Asia, we see the Indian economy starting to accelerate, turning in some nice economic growth rates. And as that broad-based economic growth continues, they too will have a major impact on the world demand for cereals. As purchasing power increases, we've seen it in Bangalore and other cities in India, that there's an immense increase in consumption of dairy products, of poultry products in particular. So my projection of the world demand for food in 2050 is twice as big as at the turn of the century in the year 2000. 50% increase in population from 6 to 9 billion, and a like increase in demand caused by the growth in purchasing power. But to repeat, how many low-income people successfully escape poverty will be the single most important determinant of the future global demand for food. Now, trade implications. I'd like to have you focus on the dark red wedge on the right of these two pie charts and the pink wedge on the left. On the right chart, we have the percentage distribution of population in various regions of the world. On the left graph, we have the percentage distribution of arable land around the world. But when you look at that dark red wedge, which represents East Asia, the pink wedge, which represents South Asia, we see that together they have more than twice as much of the world's population than of the arable land. Virtually all of their arable land is in use. It's in agricultural production. There's virtually no more land that can be brought in. And as a result, it's very difficult for me to construe a scenario in which either East or Southeast Asia or South Asia can possibly be self-sufficient in food in the future, no matter how much they invest in research or in promoting agricultural development. The other wedge I would point to is the small purple wedge in the southwest corner of those two pie charts. This is North Africa and the Middle East, both with 5% of the arable land and 5% of the population, and their population is growing rapidly, and incomes are rising rapidly. But of course, this region, it's scarcity of water that will motivate them to be larger net importers of food, particularly grains, in the future. So, with population growth, urbanization that's going on, causing demand, consumption patterns to change, and broad-based economic development that lifts the maximum number of people out of their poverty, many low-income countries' food consumption growth will outstrip their production capacity, and they will become larger net importers of food in the future. So, what about the supply side? This is a very optimistic scenario, I think, about the growth in demand and the opportunities that are going to be there for international trade in the grains markets. Now, when we look at the constraints on future supply potential in the world, The first thing we have to do, of course, is look at land, the most fundamental resource in agriculture production. And when we look at it, there's only about 12% more arable land available worldwide that isn't covered with trees or subject to erosion or desertification. And we know there's degradation of many soils going on. Now, we could double the acres of land or hectares of land and production worldwide, but it would cause massive destruction of forests, and with it we'd lose wildlife habitat, we'd lose biodiversity, we'd reduce the carbon sequestration capacity, accelerating global warming, all unacceptable environmental outcomes. Now, most of that 12% additional land is in South America and sub-Saharan Africa, generally inferior in quality to the land that's in production, and will certainly require larger investments in both infrastructure and research if it's to be made productive. Now, this map of the world shows where the croplands, or the principal croplands, are today. And the way to interpret it is the darker the shading, the higher the percent of land under that pixel that's in crop production today. So the darkest areas are the most intensively farmed areas. And of course, we see in South Asia, particularly in the Indo-Gangetic Plain, intensive use of the land. Eastern Europe, Central Asia, again, very intensive use of the land. The U.S. Corn Belt, northeastern China, several other spots in China, Southeast Asia. But we do notice in south of the equator how much lighter the shading is, and this indeed is where the potential for that 12% more land that could be in production resides. Now, when we look to the future agriculture production, we also have to worry about climate, of course. And as we look across the northern hemisphere, those big blue areas, both dark blue and light blue, this constraint on agriculture production, of course, is cold temperature. But we have global warming occurring. In fact, global warming has been happening since the end of the last little ice age at the beginning of the 19th century. One of the first and most compelling conclusions of the meteorologists who are making these long-term projections is that temperature will rise more over land than over water, and the temperature will rise more close to the North Pole than at the equator. So we can anticipate that that margin of cultivation imposed by the cold temperature across the northern hemisphere will indeed be relaxed, and we will be able to produce more grains further north into Canada, into the former Soviet Union as well. Big question mark, what happens to precipitation? Unfortunately, the long-term climate projection models are nowhere near in as much agreement on rainfall as they are in temperature. But we do have some indications about rainfall, which I'll turn to in just a couple of minutes. But before I do that, we do have to acknowledge the other most important natural resource in food production, water. Farmers use about 70% of the fresh water used in the world today. With the rapid urbanization that's going on, cities are likely to outbid farmers for available water. Last year, for the first time in the history of humanity, more than half of the world's population lived in cities. That's projected to rise to 60% by 2030, 70% by the middle of the century. If 70% of the world's populations are in cities, the world's farmers will not have access to 70% of the fresh water. It simply will not happen. The cities will outbid farmers for the available water. So we're talking about the world's farmers doubling production, using at most 10 or 12% more land and using less water than today, for both food, feed, as well as biofuels production. Now, one thing that gives us a little hope in the water area is the fact that water is priced at zero to most of the world's farmers. And so there's really not nearly enough incentive to use the water efficiently. Now, I do not underestimate the political difficulty of beginning to charge farmers for water who never in history have, in places where they never in history have had to pay anything for water. But there, at least with appropriate incentives, it should be possible to significantly increase the efficiency with which we use the water we use in agriculture. Now, again, back to land area, how much can cropland expand? Well, the main area of expansion in recent decades has been in that red and brown area in central west part of Brazil. We look straight east in the same latitudes in sub-Saharan Africa. We see a very similar soil situation. And so technically, it should be possible to bring that area of land in Africa into production. But many things, of course, have to be done before that's going to happen. Investments in infrastructure, changes in public policy, investments in agriculture research. So putting all of this together, we need to double the food system productivity between now and the middle of the century, make presently unusable soils productive, to increase the genetic potential of the crops we grow now, achieve as much of that potential as we can by improving the nutrition of the crops, reducing competition from weeds for water, nutrients, and sunlight, reducing the losses from disease and insects, and, of course, reduce post-harvest losses. All of these have great potential for increasing productivity. And when we look at grain yields around the world, as you see on this map, we see a huge variation in grain yields from region to region in the world. The way to interpret the map is the lowest yields are dark blue, and as you move up through the color spectrum to deep red, you go from the lowest to the highest yields. And when we look worldwide, there are only a few areas that are orange to red here in the U.S. Corn Belt, Northern Europe, the up in Heilongjiang, northeastern China. The yellow areas, again, a larger area in the central west of the U.S., of Western Europe, eastern China, as well as northeastern China. But then as we get down into the green area, which is actually closer to the average yields worldwide, we get extensive area in South America, more in China, southeastern Australia, eastern Europe, the fringes around the Corn Belt in the U.S. But we get down to the dark blue, which is virtually all of sub-Saharan Africa and significant parts of India below the Indo-Gangetic Plain, and also in the stands of the former Soviet Union in Central Asia, that we have extremely low yields. Now, some of this is associated with precipitation in soils, but a great deal of it's associated with underinvestment in research, lack of public policy that provides the appropriate incentives to adopt the improved technologies that are already available. So the point I want to make here is that there are many parts of the world where there is great potential to increase agricultural productivity if we've got to double the average productivity worldwide over the next 40 years. We have a number of regions where it can increase significantly, but we also, with the investments that are being made, particularly in the private sector in this country, in agriculture research, we have still a long ways to go in increasing productivity in corn production, in wheat production, soybean production in the United States as well. Now, climate change that we've talked about will complicate our lives a bit more. We're going to need to invest in research to double the productivity worldwide. But with all ecosystems shifting with global climate change, it's going to be necessary to invest more in research just to sustain present productivity levels in those regions. We're likely to see greater variation in precipitation, probably some reduction in precipitation in the subtropics, significant increases in the higher latitudes, the same places that are expected to have cold climate or the cold constraint reduced, probably some increase in flow of precipitation under the monsoons. But we also are likely to have increased frequency of extreme events such as droughts and flooding, which means that the ability to deal with extreme events like droughts is also going to be an important characteristic to breed into our crops as we move forward. But we will need adaptations in response to climate change, and we need adaptive plant and animal breeding for that matter, just as has been done throughout the last decades, most of the 20th century, to relax the physical constraints in given regions of the world, such as introducing more drought tolerance, more heat tolerance. Some places in the world will need to change the mix of what crops are produced in a given geographic location. And we will probably see this force also lead to an increase in the amount of agricultural production moving through international markets. that it will be necessary to compensate for the effects of climate change in some regions of the world. But we have great potential in agriculture research. Yes, we probably have pretty much utilized the productivity-enhancing potential of green revolution technologies, but biotechnology has opened tremendous new frontiers. And in fact, we're in the golden age of the biological sciences. Applications in human medicine have led to phenomenal improvement in our health status, but biotechnology has equal potential for improvements in our agricultural production systems. It creates the opportunity to increase the nutritional content of grains, increase tolerance to drought, to wetness, to temperature, to salt, to aluminum toxicity, to internalize resistance to diseases and viruses, reduce pesticide use, building in insecticides, herbicide-resistant varieties that reduce the energy intensity of production, and biotech also has the potential to slow down product deterioration and reduce the post-harvest losses. So now approaching the end of my presentation and looking at the policy issues, some of the challenges, as well as opportunities as we look to the future. We have prohibitively high tariffs in some parts of the world that need to be negotiated down, and we are in a round of WTO trade negotiations, unfortunately slowed down due to the world financial crisis, but I expect we'll still see them wrap up within another couple of years. We have binding tariff rate quotas in many parts of the world that restrict access to markets from more efficiently produced product. We need to reduce subsidies that are linked to the production of specific commodities that distort what gets produced where. We really need a ban to both export subsidies as well as export embargoes. The experience of 2008 with the spike in prices scared some countries away from relying on international markets for as much of their food security as they were intending to. As we said before, the benefit of trade are so great that it makes no sense to embargo exports, but you have to have each country has to have the reputation for being a reliable supplier, and I believe the U.S. has firmly accepted that it was a terrible mistake when we did have that one experience with export embargoes, and my sense is that there is no possibility of that happening again. We need to continue to ensure that sanitary and phytosanitary barriers to trade are science-based. We need harmonization of standards. We need to streamline customs procedures, all issues that are being addressed in the WTO trade negotiations. So putting all this together, what are the long-term prospects? Well, another of those fathers of economics, Thomas Robert Malthus, a preacher in Scotland, who also wrote a famous text in economics, I think we could properly label a prophet of doom when he argued that population growth would outstrip the food production capacity of the planet and eventually starvation would limit the size of the world's population. Well, Malthus has been wrong for more than two centuries. And why was he wrong? He underestimated the power of investments in agriculture research to raise productivity faster than demand has grown. In fact, he only looked at the demographic side. He didn't even take into account the effect of growing purchasing power on increasing demand for food in the world. And because those public and private investments in agriculture research raised productivity faster than demand grew, we actually had a 150-year downward trend in the real price of cereal grains after taking out the effects of inflation. We need a big increase in world food production by 2050 using less water and little more land than today, and also to produce biofuels feedstocks. But I'm a technology optimist. In the golden age of the biological sciences, which we find ourselves today, as long as we make the necessary investments in the public and the private sectors in agriculture research, there is no reason that there shouldn't be plenty of production to satisfy the rapidly growing demand that I project well into the 21st century. Future price trends will depend on whether agriculture research increases land and water productivity faster than world demand grows. But as I say, I'm a technology optimist who believes that there would be no excuse for us to have to move to that higher or that higher price trend in the future. But I think we will be in a world of greater risk. Commodity prices, including energy prices, may be somewhat higher than historical trend, but with larger variance around that trend. There are also questions about the financial status of the world economy and several regional economies since the financial crisis of September 2008. The macroeconomic environment in particular, I think, is something we have to keep an eye on with the effects on exchange rates. We know the exchange rates have bounced around significantly over the last decades. But as I look at the long-term trend, the United States dollar, I see nothing over the extended period that would lead me to anything but an expectation of a declining value of the U.S. dollar. When the government of China owns over $1 trillion worth of U.S. government paper, the government of Japan owns over $800 billion of U.S. government paper, the overhang of our debt internationally, I believe, will keep the downward pressure on the U.S. dollar. The only reason it's as strong as it is today is because the euro is so weak, because of the fears related to Greece, Ireland, Portugal. Climate change certainly will introduce more risk, and as will the possibility of changes in public policy and regulations. But everyone in this industry needs to be active with their respective governments in making sure that we move towards a freer and more open international trading environment with as few nuisance regulations as possible. So to put this all together, in my concluding slide, the world's arable land is not distributed around the world in the same proportions as population, and I see no way for Asia or North Africa and the Middle East to be self-sufficient in cereal grain production. They will be larger net importers. Agriculture in most low-income countries is underperforming relative to its potential, but the disincentives have been declining, but there remain a number of significant challenges, such as investments in infrastructure, in governance, in agriculture research investments, particularly in places like sub-Saharan Africa, where much of the remaining additional land is. Greater trading opportunities for low-income countries would accelerate their economic growth and accelerate growth in their food consumption and imports. This is one of the important objectives of this round of trade negotiations, and we certainly need a successful WTO Doha round, which has been dubbed the development round, the markets of the future in developing countries. Developing countries impose greater barriers to trade among themselves than the high-income countries impose on their exports. All of us need for us to have a successful Doha round to continue to grow trade in the manner in which it needs to grow in the future. With that, let me stop and take your questions. Thank you very much for your attention.